You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Now for the evening news.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old rocking chair's got me.
Old rocking chair got your father.
$1.8 million people surrounded on all sides. Refugees since 48, since 67, occupied.
Listen to Labor Radio, Monday, August 11th at 6 p.m. as we interview Michael Letwin from Labor for Palestine.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Where's the front sheet?
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear about a rally for Gaza held in Portland this weekend.
Healthcare premium rates for next year in Oregon have been announced, and at least one local company is unhappy with the result.
Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is in New York at a conference on equity, which is being held in a mansion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 11th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Very sad news today. Actor Robin Williams was found dead Monday morning in his California home. According to the Marin County Sheriff's Office, a 911 call was received at 11:55 a.m. Williams was pronounced dead at 12:02 of a possible suicide. Robin Williams began his TV career as Mork from Ork on the TV show Happy Days. This character was so popular that it spun off into his own series, Mork and Mindy, which ran from 1978 to 1982. Williams had a successful movie career with films such as The World According to Garp, Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, Mrs. Doubtfire, and more. In 1998, Williams won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his role in Good Will Hunting, directed by Portland-based filmmaker Gus Van Sant. Over the years, Williams has dealt with substance abuse. His publicist said he'd been battling severe depression. Williams' wife, Susan Schneider, released a statement saying she is heartbroken and hopes he's remembered for the countless moments of joy and laughter he gave to millions. He was 63 years old.
Hundreds of Portlanders gathered in Waterfront Park yesterday to challenge the ongoing Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. Here's a sample of sound from the rally.
Together with the global network of Kairos Palestine Witness, and in honor of those who resist evil and refuse to give up steadfast hope, in expression of our hunger to join closely with the people who suffer, Kairos USA calls the Kairos community into a personal fast of one meal each week on your holy day. We fast because the children of Gaza are hungry, because incarcerated ones fast in prison, because the harvests and the trees in the West Bank are destroyed, because fishing off the coast of Gaza is rendered nearly impossible, because the land of milk and honey is attacked and violated, because walls have taken the place of broad places and open horizons. We fast because those who grieve have lost their appetite.
BDS is a very, very strong movement, and you have the key, and you can use it. From here, I will say thank you all for coming, and I hope everybody who has a name, as I have, to start Google it and research about this name and learn about the name, the person, life, how was he, see his picture or her picture. Try to introduce yourself to his or her life. You know, you might find the name that you have, not just an adult or woman, or you might have this as a kid, you know. Give yourself the opportunity to know this kid and to know this person, because you know you cannot go without having a personal connection to the issue that you are fighting for and standing for. From personal connection, you can start and do a global change. So I'm encouraging all of you to do that. Thank you very, very much. And again, free Palestine. Free Gaza. Free
Gaza. So some of you look up right now and you say, well, what is an African man doing up here talking about the Palestinian people? But if you say that, that's because you don't know the history. Because all you have to do is, I have to mention one name to you. And we go back just 40 years to the 1960s. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, y'all know who they were? All right. They had a chairperson by the name of Kwame Ture. You knew him then as Stokely Carmichael. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, an African organization, was the first organization in this country to come out against Zionist Israel in 1967. That is a fact. That is a fact. And it was from that effort that Kwame, when he left SNCC and went to Guinea, West Africa, and began to organize for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, that's when exposing the dirty, vicious nature of this Zionist system became a top priority for us all over the world. So since that time, and all of my adult life in this organization, we have set out to educate our people about Zionism, about the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, and about how the Zionist movement has been financed on the backs of African people. Y'all didn't know that. Read a book, it's called Wiseman and Smuts. It talks about after Theodore Herzl, the so-called father of Zionism, this man, Shame Wiseman, rose up and he began to build relationships with Azania, South Africa in the 1920s. And that's how the diamond pipeline was built. Today, diamond refining is still one of the major exports of the Zionist occupiers, and there's not one diamond mine in Israel. There's not one diamond mine there. Those diamonds come from Zimbabwe, from South Africa, Azania, South Africa, from Mozambique. That's where they're coming from, where our people get paid $10 a month to get black lung to dig them up. So we got to be anti-Zionists. We have to be.
Those were some of the sounds from yesterday's rally in Portland to end the Israeli siege and assault on the Gaza Strip. Organizers say they're planning an action at Senator Merkley's office in the coming week that will likely include civil disobedience. As the refugee crisis in northern Iraq grows more complicated, American and UK government officials have been talking about how they will not be involved in Iraq long term. Recently, the United Kingdom has considered sending troops to the region to help those fleeing ISIS fighters. Several UK government officials, such as Lord Donet, believe that their country bears some responsibility for the breakdown in Iraqi society after 2003. Donet went on to say that the risk of an unfolding genocide means that aid to the area needs to improve. The UK has ruled out aiding American airstrikes against ISIS forces. However, measures to provide arms to Kurdish forces engaging ISIS have not been dismissed. We'll have a full report and analysis on the situation in Iraq following the newscast at 5:45 with Professor Vijay Prashad. So be sure to stay tuned for that.
The Oregon Health Co-op agreed today to accept a decision by a state board to allow a 10% decrease in rates for next year instead of the 20% decrease they had proposed. If the co-op had not agreed with the decision, they would have been unable to participate in the health exchange for the coming year. Health co-op owners were told that they could request an evidentiary hearing to challenge the decision, but such a hearing would take months and would force them to miss the deadline to participate in Oregon's health exchange for next year. For more, KBOO's Jinka Soderberg spoke with Ralph Prowse, the president and CEO of the Oregon Health Co-op.
I wonder if you can give us an update as to what has been going on between the Oregon Health Co-op and the State Insurance Commission that has said you can't cut rates as much as you would hope to.
Well, thank you, Jenka. Yes, in the last week or so, we were notified by the Insurance Division that our 21% rate reduction request was being cut back, and they were going to approve about a 10% rate reduction, which is good news, but it's not as good a news as we'd hoped for. We asked for an opportunity to talk with them about that decision. They didn't exactly give us that opportunity. What they did allow was for us to listen to their explanation last Friday, and we did that. I had two lead actuaries from Milliman, the two individuals, both fellows of the Society of Actuaries, on the call to listen. We had about an hour and a half a meeting with them about that. Of course, as I mentioned, this was not an opportunity to have a dialogue or to ask questions or vet any of the things we heard, but it was an opportunity to listen to their version of things. And frankly, it was a little bit surprising because up until now, we've had about a month of back and forth, questions and answers, written form. We also had a public hearing. And the thing that was surprising is that in none of those conversations did we ever hear what we heard on Friday. This was completely new reasoning that we had never had an opportunity to discuss before. And frankly, our actuaries were very surprised. Their feeling is that there are significant misunderstandings and probably some, and definitely some errors in some of the points that were made on Friday, but unfortunately we have no opportunity to discuss that. Meanwhile, we had until 8 o'clock this morning to indicate to the Insurance Division whether we were going to go forward and accept their 10% rate reduction. Of course, we did accept it this morning. Otherwise, we would not have been able to offer insurance to the individual market in Oregon. And the only other option we had was to ask for what's called an evidentiary hearing, which is a legal process. It would have taken many, many months to conclude that, not nearly in time to complete the things that need to be completed.
And if people aren't familiar with the Oregon Health Co-op, can you talk about how it's different from other insurance plans in the state?
We are a consumer-operated and oriented nonprofit health plan. Consumer-operated and oriented, you know, being translated to co-op. But we're significantly different in that we are all about listening to what our membership and what Oregonians want in healthcare, and then actualizing what they want into real insurance programs and products. And that's what we started doing 2 years ago. And we have built from that ever since. And of course, that raises that's a challenge. We have talked with thousands of Oregonians. We've been all over the Portland area doing this now for 2 years. And what we've learned is that people want affordability. That's why we've been pushing this price point down. We've learned that people want to get rid of the gimmicks and the gotchas in healthcare. That's why we eliminated coinsurance and deductibles, and we just have copayments. So it's really simple for people to get. We learned people wanted naturopaths as primary care. We're the only health plan in the country that added that. In our case, we have relatively low administrative costs because we don't spend money doing a lot of things that other health plans do. We keep that down, and we don't post any profitability based upon some of these investment strategies that competitors have. Ours is really all about keeping premiums down and building health programs for our membership. And that membership is going to run us. We're electing a new board of directors this year, and those will be elected from among our membership to make sure that from now on, it's part of our DNA to make sure that we're focused on what our consumers, what Oregonians really want, instead of some of the things that health insurance companies, other health insurance companies have done.
And so I guess it's not part of your plan to pay for naming rights for stadiums, for example.
Well, you would never see that happen, actually. You would never, ever see that happen. I mean, what Oregonian wants to see their premium dollars rebranding sports centers? I don't know of any. I mean, why would anyone want their healthcare dollars spent that way? That could never happen here.
And, of course, it does happen with Moda and with Providence, both of which have spent tens of millions of dollars to rename both the Blazers and the Timbers Stadium.
And I don't see how that's improving the health of Oregonians in any way. And we're restricted by law, actually, from doing anything like that. We can really only use profits to do one of three things, that is, reduce premiums, build health programs, and repay our federal loans. That's it. We can't do those things.
That's because you're a nonprofit?
Yes, we're a nonprofit, and I mean, we're a whole new category of nonprofit, actually. And we can't pay the kinds of exorbitant executive salaries. We can't rebrand sports centers. We can't spend money on new startup for-profit enterprises. None of these kinds of activities that you see some of our competitors doing.
Oh, we need promos. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales is currently in New York with a group of other mayors talking about equity. They're gathered at Gracie Mansion, where the U.S. Conference of Mayors is supplying Hales and other mayors with receptions and meals. They're talking about how their cities can best serve the poor, but no one who is actually poor themselves is taking part in the event. Mayor Hales wrote in a press release that he thinks a lot of other cities want to learn from Portland about equity, and he hopes to teach other mayors while he serves on the task force. The meeting at the mansion comes just after the city council voted against increasing funding for affordable housing and approved a controversial plan to redevelop Old Town. Homeless rights advocates in the city of Portland have been vocal in their criticism of the redevelopment plan, which they say will displace the few remaining social services that actually serve the poorest people in Portland.
Mayor Hales in the press release says that he hopes that other cities will be able to learn from Portland on this issue. What are some of the things that Portland is doing that the mayor's office is hoping other cities will learn from?
A couple of big things, one that's really obvious and one that's not really obvious. The obvious one is that Portland is right in the process right now of rewriting the comprehensive plan. As you know, it's 30 years since we've had a master redo of a comp plan. And the comp plan is the overlay of zoning and how we use all of our land in the city. And in the past, it has not ever been done with an equity lens, which has led to gentrification issues. So specifically going to the Planning and Sustainability and the Portland Development Commission and the Housing Commission saying, look, as we rewrite the zoning and as we rewrite the comp plan, let us think about equity, let us think about gentrification, let us make sure we don't make in the future some of the errors we've made in the past. That one is not as obvious for people to see. It's tougher. Another one that he's done was he took a three-day training session on issues of equity and brought with him all of the white male administrators in his office, plus all of the white male command staff of the police bureau, and spent 3 days at a training called White Men as Full Diversity Partners talking about equity issues. To our knowledge, no other mayor has ever mandated 3 days of training for the top cops, nor sat in it himself you know, to say, look, I'm not just talking about this. I'm here at the table with you to really focus this at, to show that it is his priority. So things like that are some of the stuff that we've been doing. Another thing that he's been doing is the Black Male Achievement Initiative, in which he's been working with the public sector, the private sector, the faith community, the education community, to try and find the benchmarks by which we can measure new successes for young African-American men.
That diversity training was criticized by some in the community for being a white male retreat, where people challenged that. Do you feel that that was the best way to address the issue of diversity and equity in the city for that?
Absolutely. What the mayor said, a couple of things. One is, no other mayor has ever spent 3 days with the command staff, captains, commanders, assistant chiefs, and chiefs before. You know, that alone is good. Secondly, the mayor said that equity is one of his priorities, and he wanted his top command staff to understand that and to really believe it. We did get, as you heard, a great deal of criticism. One of the major Portland media said, gosh, we shouldn't have spent that much money on equity because clearly that isn't that big an issue here in Portland. False. Of course it is. We have a huge problem here. And if you are going to address equity, you've got to address the white men in your audience, that is to say in your command staff and your leadership positions, because that's the essence of who has to change and who has to grow in our growingly diverse community. If we want to serve this Portland in all of its wholeness and complexity, the white guys who are in charge, and you and I both know that people who look like me and talk like me and sound like me are the guys in charge, they have to be the ones at the table.
One of the other things that has been criticized in the last couple of weeks has been the decision to approve Airbnb rentals and not approve putting the tax money from that estimated $500,000 toward affordable housing, which is what Dan Saltzman had proposed doing with it. What's the mayor's response to that?
In the last 18 months when he's been in office, every time there's been an opportunity to put actual money into housing, the city council has voted yes, and they voted unanimously yes. That included in spring 2013 when they held the safety net harmless, in fall 2013 when they reinvested $1.7 million towards housing, this winter when they added an additional $20 million over the next 5 years for affordable housing in the Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard area. That was the mayor acting unilaterally on that one. We have an independent city budget office, and the independent city budget office has been saying earmarks are a terrible way to govern. They're really dumb, and they tie the hands of future elected officials in ways that you really don't want to do. And so he's spent the last two budgets getting rid of earmarks and limiting the earmarks and putting more money into the general fund so actual decisions based on policy can be made. It's aligning your pocketbook and your heart with your brain. And he believes in that thoroughly. In this instance, this would have increased by another, I don't know, several hundred thousand dollars, some more money going to housing. When the next budget cycle rolls around and when we do the next 6 months worth of debate, you can bet a lot more money than that's going to be proposed. You can bet it's going to pass unanimously.
At this Cities of Opportunity Task Force, will the mayors be meeting with anyone who is poor to talk about equity?
I'm not sure. Mayor de Blasio put it together and it's ended. It's about 6-7 o'clock their time, and it ended some time ago. And I don't know, with other than the mayors themselves and the elected officials that got together, I don't know with whom they met.
Now, this meeting has been at the Gracie Mansion in New York. What do you think that image puts across as far as dealing with issues of equity and meeting in a mansion to do so?
I have no thoughts about that. I think that's where Bill de Blasio holds conferences when he brings people together. I'm not sure where that is, but that's what it's called.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dana Haynes from the Mayor of Portland's office, from Mayor Charlie Hales' office. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dana Haynes.
Our pleasure.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A Portland police officer was arrested on suspicion of drunk driving after crashing into a fire hydrant in Gresham. The 43-year-old sergeant, James McMurray, is an 18-year veteran of the Portland Police Force. In addition to the fire hydrant, McMurray hit a fence and his car damaged a yard. He was taken to the police department in Gresham and offered a blood alcohol test. The city declined to answer whether or not he took the test. He was cited for driving under the influence,
reckless driving, and second-degree criminal mischief, and then released. Gresham police pointed out that they treated the officer no differently than any other suspect. Former Portland Mayor Sam Adams faced a similar situation while he was in office when he crashed into a car toy store in Jansen Beach. But Portland police officers on the scene at that incident declined to give the mayor a breathalyzer test.
An investigation by OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, has ordered a Gresham Trucking Company owner to rehire a driver who refused to drive on tires she considered unsafe. She was fired 8 days after she changed a tire before going on a trip. After being fired, she filed a whistleblower's complaint against the owner. Her firing violated a federal law that makes it illegal to fire an employee who refuses to operate an unsafe vehicle. Her employer, Terry Unrein, will be required to pay over $115,000 in back wages until he makes a job offer. He will also have to pay nearly $3,000 in attorney's fees as well. Mr. Unrein claims that the driver was fired for having 3 accidents in 90 days. He also claims that his fleet is inspected regularly to prevent safety hazards. He has appealed the decision with OSHA.
You may have noticed that the sky is a little hazy around the Portland area lately. 16 wildfires have been burning across Oregon and Washington with no immediate end in sight. Additional wildfires in Northern California are adding to the problem. Lightning storms in both states are expected to increase the potential for more large fires toward the end of the week. Nearly 470,000 acres are currently burning. Over 10,000 firefighters and support personnel are working around the clock trying to curtail the blaze. Homes, ranches, historic structures, and more are threatened. Some residents are on alert to evacuate, while residents near the Devil's Elbow Fire have mandatory evacuation orders.
In Gold Hill, a town in southern Oregon, 4 of the 6 city council members face a recall after voting to allow Rogue Valley's first medical marijuana facility. Margaret Dials, one of the council members facing recall, noted that the city put a 5% tax on the medical marijuana sales, and Gold Hill is benefiting to the tune of $100 to $150 per day as a result. The owner of the medical marijuana store will be holding an open house on Wednesday to allow residents to see how the shop operates before they vote in the recall election.
When the going gets tough, Congress gets going.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Vijay Prahat, followed by Hard Knock Radio at 6. We hear an interview with Michael Letwin from Labor for Palestine and others about the steps union members here and around the world are taking to stop the siege of Gaza and oppose the long-term occupation of Palestine. At 6:30, it's Labor Radio, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms are likely, mainly before midnight. Some of the storms could produce small hail and gusty winds. Mostly cloudy with a low around 65, with a chance of precipitation at 60%. Tomorrow will be cooler with a high near 84 and a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms. If you're interested in the radcast alert levels for the radiation counts in the Portland and Washington, Oregon area, please check at radcast.org.
Today in history, in 1964, the Beatles movie, A Hard Day's Night, had its U.S. premiere in New York. And in 1965, the Watts riots claimed 34 lives in the city of Los Angeles. The quote of the day is from Maya Angelou. A bird doesn't sing because it has an answer. It sings because it has a song. Very good.
in the studio with three Texans, which means it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When the going gets tough, Congress gets going. On vacation, that is. They're taking off this entire month and much of September and October. Having howled about a host of huge issues, including the humanitarian crisis of immigrant children crossing the U.S.-Mexico border and the growing crisis of our nation's crumbling infrastructure, Congress did nothing, then bolted off the job. Okay, they did do one thing. They filed a frivolous lawsuit against President Obama, charging that he's been governing unilaterally by issuing executive orders. But there are at least three big problems with their suit. One, Obama has issued far fewer executive orders than did George W., his GOP predecessor. Two, they claim that the president defied Congress by inadequately implementing the Obama health care reform. But, hello, Republicans fought that reform tooth and nail and are still trying to stop it from being implemented, meaning they're suing him for not doing something they don't want done. And three, as they departed for vacation, howling House leaders said that in their absence, Obama should deport the suffering, terrorized migrant children who fled to the U.S. this summer. Incredibly, they demanded that, get this, the president should act unilaterally by issuing an executive order. These GOP Congress critters are nutty ideological zealots, but luckily, they're also incompetent. Nonetheless, they are clogging the roadway, preventing any of the progress that America desperately needs. As a result, not only is the public fed up with them, but voter turnout is plummeting this year as people see that the Hell No faction has turned Democratic participation into a farce. So why bother? This is Jim Hightower saying, it's okay that these right-wingers are killing themselves, but it's not okay that they're also snuffing out America's democracy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Global labor unions are sending medical supplies to Gaza to help the thousands of civilians wounded by Israeli military attacks. The International Transport Workers Federation, the ITF, is supported in this humanitarian mission by global union federations, including UNI and IUF. Stephen Cotton, acting general secretary of the ITF, explained global labor's humanitarian aid effort in Gaza to Canada's Radio Labor.
We're able to get a plane into Gaza to try and provide support, but our second convoy is about to go. Basically, we're trying to bring medical supplies, which are for the injured people in Gaza. Got a list of things here that are going on this convoy. Surgical operations table of medicines, just trying to provide some supplies, medical supplies to help. Those supplies are going to the Jordan Hazimite charity organization, which is directly engaged in providing crisis relief and directly involved with the United Nations. And we're hoping, you know, that will go directly to the people, the innocent civilians who are in need of that support. And we've been very lucky in the sense that our Jordanian office, which is our Arab World office, headed by Bilal Makhali, has been able to get the contributions are coming in are being doubled by the Jordanian connections. And so we're kind of getting double money for the process. And we've had great support from some of the other global union federations. UNI and IUF have already contributed. It's not normal for global union federations to directly contribute, but we've got kind of started a new area of very, very close cooperation.
The ITF has condemned the Israeli airstrikes into Gaza as a disproportionate response that's daily killing civilians. ITF President Patty Crumlin said that we strongly condemn the strikes by the Israeli military, which are being launched into one of the most densely populated areas in the world. We call for the urgent implementation of the UN Security Council's call for an immediate ceasefire. The ITF has a member union in Gaza, the Gaza Bus Drivers Union. The International Trade Union Confederation and Industrial Global Union are also responding in a global action campaign to lobby governments for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and humanitarian aid to civilians. The unions say targeting civilians is against international law, and they're calling for accountability and justice.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The owner of the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan that suffered a full nuclear meltdown during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami has applied to the Japanese government for permission to pump contaminated groundwater into the Pacific Ocean. An ice wall designed to stop contaminated groundwater from flowing into the ocean has failed to freeze the water for more than 3 months now, leaving more than 400 tons of radioactive water per day flowing into the ocean. Groundwater is entering the cement basement containment area and flowing over the still molten fuel cores before flowing into the ocean. TEPCO has been pumping some of the water from the containment area and storing the highly radioactive water in tanks, but have run out of room for new tanks. Many of the old tanks are corroding and leaking the stored radioactive water back into the ground, worsening the crisis. The new plan that TEPCO has applied to the Japanese government for permission to use is to filter the radioactive water, removing as much radioactivity as possible before discharging the water into the Pacific Ocean. TEPCO admits that this method at full capacity will only be able to treat 200 tons of water, less than half of the current daily radioactive water released into the Pacific Ocean. Critics argue that the plan is inadequate because the filtration system does not remove tritium and many other radioactive isotopes contaminating the groundwater at the plant. As the radioactive water releases increases, cancer rates are also spiking in the Fukushima region. Up to 48% of all children tested in Fukushima are now showing precancerous thyroid abnormalities, and actual cancer rates have risen 40 times the previous cancer rates since the 2011 meltdown.
And now we go to our friends at Independent Native News for the top headlines from an Indigenous perspective.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The South Dakota Highway Patrol will work with the Crow Creek Tribe and South Dakota's Department of Public Safety this weekend. They've signed a memorandum of understanding for the joint effort. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Highway Patrol and BIA Crow Creek Agency Police worked together for the Dakota Nation powwow in 2013. Results were so positive, the Crow Creek Tribe asked for additional assistance this year. State Highway Patrol troopers will assist tribal police during this weekend's powwow in Fort Thompson, South Dakota. Some of the troopers will use drug detection dogs during the event. The Highway Patrol will coordinate its efforts with the police chief of the Crow Creek Agency. Troopers involved in this weekend's enforcement effort will go through a training and orientation session and be sworn in Thursday to work on tribal land. South Dakota Highway Patrol Superintendent Colonel Craig Price says the more state and tribal agencies can cooperate and work together, the better off all state residents are. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Representatives from Washington football team's Original Americans Foundation will be at Zuni Pueblo in New Mexico today. A notice sent out by the tribe says they're looking to buy art. The message has angered many people who voice concern on social media. People are pointing to the movement to change the mascot and are also upset that the message tells artists to be respectful and not smell of alcohol or marijuana or be under the influence. A tribal administrator told USA Today Sports that their economy is depressed and buyers often insist artists cut their prices, but believes the foundation will pay full price. This summer, we've been following the controversy involving rocker Ted Nugent and Native Americans. Some tribal casinos recently canceled Nugent's concerts, including the Coeur d'Alene tribe, due to what a representative called Nugent's history of racist and hate-filled remarks. Social media posts and headlines attributed Nugent's unclean vermin comments to Native Americans. In an interview with National Native News, Nugent says he did not call Native American people unclean vermin.
I have never referenced my blood brothers, my Native American, the various Indians in America who I consider my blood brothers. I have never in my life said anything negative or disrespectful towards any of them ever.
He says he used those terms to describe protesters at his concerts in Connecticut and New Jersey. Nugent says it was the media which connected him with those two words and Native Americans.
The media literally took my statement about some stinky hippies and claimed that I said it about Native Americans. Yes, they made it up.
Nugent says it's unfortunate his shows were canceled at the tribal casinos. He's also been criticized for wearing a headdress, and when asked what he would like to say to Native Americans who take offense, he had this to say.
I tell them to get a life. I was given headdresses by the elders of many tribes as a thank you gift, and I've been welcomed into them. I saw where President Obama wore a headdress, and I saw where Stevie Ray Vaughan wore a headdress, and President Carter and President Reagan. And I think tonight in a casino in Michigan, there are the, what's the name of that band where the YMCA, what's the name of that band? They're playing at an Indian casino tonight in Michigan, and one of the members of the band wears a headdress. I mean, you got to be kidding me. So somebody can tell me what I can wear? Should I be able to tell someone they can't wear a suit and a tie or they can't wear blue jeans? I mean, are you serious?
In our interview, Nugent also responded to Native American protesters at Sturgis and discussed racism in America. To hear the extended conversation, visit the National Native News Facebook page. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org, brought to you by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The FBI has launched an investigation into the shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a police officer in a suburb outside St. Louis, Missouri. The investigation comes after widespread outrage and protests over the shooting spiraled into rioting on Sunday night. 18-year-old Michael Brown was killed on Saturday afternoon after a struggle with a Ferguson police officer. Witnesses claim that Brown had his hands in the air when the officer shot and killed him. Protesters want the shooter to be identified, fired, and charged with killing Brown. In addition, they want the mostly white Ferguson police force to better reflect the racial demographic of the African American community. The shooting has received widespread attention across the nation. Attorney General Eric Holder asked the Department of Justice's civil rights attorneys to monitor the situation and determine whether Brown's civil rights were violated. In addition, the NAACP says state and local branches of their organizations will investigate the shooting, and the national office will follow developments closely.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sean, Ken Jones, Jenka Soderberg, and Rosalind Scott. Our KBOO Evening News Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM and K220 HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Show, we'll take your calls, so tune in and speak up. At 9 on Alternative Radio, award-winning journalist Chris Hedges talks about Captain Ahab and the U.S. Empire. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts talks with Polo Catalani of the Colored Pencils Art and Culture Council about the Stories from Home event featuring immigrant and refugee writers and musicians. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews the visual artist Nicola Lopez, whose work looks at the built environment and traces themes of collapse and regeneration. Hey, thanks for listening to KABU Radio, and thanks KABU members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. And good night, Sean. And also good night to our special guest, Reagan and Robert, who came here from Houston. Good night, y'all.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Okay. Coming up next on KABU's News In Depth, Ken Jones speaks with Vijay Prashad, Professor of International Studies at Trinity College, about the latest breaking developments in Iraq.
Vijay, where are the current U.S. airstrikes focused in Iraq, and to what purpose?
Well, the current U.S. airstrikes are near the town of Erbil, which is the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. And what has been happening is the group known as the Islamic State had moved a large artillery battalion, which they had captured in the town of Mosul. These are American howitzers, American big guns, which had been given to the Iraqi army. These had been moved near Erbil to threaten Erbil, and that is what the American Air Force has actually targeted.
Do you believe that these airstrikes are having much effect there in terms of defeating ISIS?
Well, the airstrikes are actually not to defeat ISIS. It seems that what they are capable of doing is preventing ISIS from shelling Erbil. But I think it's very important to remember that before ISIS took those howitzers from Mosul, they had other techniques of creating chaos in the cities before they entered, you know, on their white Toyota trucks. So what they have been doing previously in Fallujah and Ramadi, you know, in Tikrit, is that they had sent in car bombs, and the car bombs operated as a form of artillery. And that used to really weaken the morale of people in the town. And then they would do a frontal assault. So just because they had seized these howitzers from Mosul, they had upped their game, as it were. So what the United States is doing is they're you know, degrading ISIS's ability to use heavy artillery against the town of Erbil, but that's different from actually taking on ISIS itself.
It gets a bit confusing, at least for me, in terms of the Muslim divisions there. There's the Shias, the Sunnis, the Kurds. Where would ISIS be on this continuum?
Well, you know, technically the media is calling them a Sunni group, but this is wrong. The Islamic State developed out of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, you know, which was a group that took advantage of the destruction of the Iraqi state when the invasion of Iraq happened in 2003. So the Al-Qaeda group morphed into the Islamic State of Iraq, which then developed much greater ambitions when Syria fell apart, and they then called themselves the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq. And subsequent to that, this year, they're simply calling themselves the Islamic State. So they are an offshoot of a kind of Al-Qaeda approach to the world. It's very hard to reduce them, therefore, to either Sunni or Shia or whatever. They have a kind of so-called Takfiri view of the world. In other words, they believe that those who are not in the narrow interpretation that they have of how Muslims should live in the world have no right to exist. You know, they are very extreme group of what are called Takfiris, or those who don't brook any dissent.
And that narrow interpretation doesn't really fit with current Shia, Sunni, or Kurdish interpretations?
It's too general. I mean, you know, the media is saying it's a Sunni group, but Sunni is a very broad definition. You know, it's like calling a group that emerges out of the Protestant tradition and becomes a hardline, vicious kind of a military group, a Protestant, organization. You know, it does a great disservice to Protestants who don't accept that very narrow, extreme version of the world. So in that sense, it does a disservice to the people who are Sunnis to call the Islamic State a Sunni organization. What it is, strictly speaking, is a Takfiri organization.
Today, the late-breaking news is that the Iraqi parliament voted to elect a new prime minister to replace current prime minister Nouri al-Maliki. Maliki belongs to the Shia majority. Do you feel that this will have much of an effect on the crisis there in terms of helping to resolve it?
Well, this has been a long-standing parliamentary problem. In the elections in April, Mr. Maliki's Dawa Party and his State of Law Coalition won only 92 seats out of a 326 or 328-seat parliament. So they needed to create alliances with other groups to form a government. In the last couple of weeks, as the Islamic State has essentially metastasized out of its its main towns of Fallujah and Ramadi, this has produced a great political crisis. And many of Mr. Maliki's allies withdrew from giving him support. But his Dawa party is actually, produced the man who is the new nominee for prime minister. In other words, the president of Iraq has chosen somebody from Mr. Maliki's own party to succeed him. So there's a crisis now, not simply in the Iraqi political circles, but inside Mr. Maliki's Dawa party itself. And it got so serious that this morning, Mr. Maliki had called for tanks to come into the city of Baghdad and surround the presidential residence of Mr. Fuad Mossam, who's the president of Iraq. So, in other words, this is an important development. It's not entirely linked to the emergence of the Islamic State, but it's also not separate from that. In other words, because the Iraqi state was destroyed by the U.S. invasion in 2003, it has not been able to recover its position. You know, you can destroy a state in an afternoon, but it takes 100 years to build a state.
You have a book, Metastasis of the Islamic State, and I was interested in that book. You mentioned the major players in the region. Could you give us a little bit about that and what their relationship is to ISIS, the Islamic State?
Yes, you know, the issue is that the Islamic State, as I said, emerges out of Al-Qaeda of Mesopotamia. It has a long history that is related to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But it would never have been able to become what it has become now without the Syrian civil war. In other words, chaos in the great Syrian desert that links the cities of Aleppo to Baghdad has allowed the Islamic State a large amount of territory and a huge amount of weapons to arm, to train, to fight, to harden itself, to conduct prison break-ins. I mean, last summer, the Islamic State broke into Abu Ghraib prison and, you know, released 500 prisoners who are now very much part of their military force. So it was the Syrian conflict that allowed, that created a vacuum and permitted the Islamic State to grow. Unless the regional powers come to an understanding that the Syrian civil war essentially is no longer simply about democracy versus authoritarianism, but is a seeding ground for the Islamic State. Unless they recognize that, unless Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., accept the fact that their position, which is that the Assad government must fall, you know, unless they accept that that position is no longer tenable, they will not be able to ally with the Syrians, the Iraqis, the Iranians, and others to help fight the Islamic State threat. Because it's indeed a threat not only to Iraq and Syria, but to the entire region.
That was actually my next question was, what do you think is the long-term solution? And I think what you're getting at there is that these non-Assad powers or anti-Assad powers like Jordan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey that you mentioned will need to ally with Iran, Iraq, the Syrian government, to counter ISIS?
Well, this afternoon in the UN Security Council, the British and the French, apart from their typical, you know, reaction of we want to bomb somebody, also mentioned the fact that the supply lines, finance, logistical assistance, etc., against the Islamic State needs to be cut. There's already a UN resolution that is supposed to enforce an embargo of the Islamic State. It is going to require a great deal of will to put pressure on the Gulf Arab states and others to stop their tacit support of the Islamic State. You know, the animosity between Iran and Saudi Arabia, fueled in great measure by Israel and the United States, needs to be tamped down. I think a summit that brings the leaders of Iran and Saudi Arabia to sit down and have a conversation is absolutely essential for the region.
What do you suggest as the U.S. Position in a longer-term solution than just bombing positions in Iraq right now?
Well, I mean, you know, the United States can do several things. It can put pressure on its allies toward a regional solution. It can start walking downwards from its maximum position on Syria. I think that's a very important, it would signal something very important for the region. I think that perhaps it's about time that the United States recognizes that after having failed to bomb countries into democracy from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya, that policy should be abandoned. You know, and this idea that you can bring freedom from 30,000 feet above the ground, that needs a very quiet burial. So this is how the United States can actually, help the region by removing itself as the principal actor. You know, the reason why U.S. airstrikes became so-called essential in Erbil is because the United States had destroyed the Iraqi Air Force in 2003 and has never really allowed it to be rebuilt. So the Iraqis don't have the capacity to deal with their own security problems. They have to call upon the United States. I think that's something that the U.S. population needs to seriously consider, that shouldn't other countries have the capacity to deal with their own threats? Why should the United States be called upon at great expense to the population to solve, you know, put out fires around the world?
What is the book Poor Nations? Is that also written about this particular situation in the Middle East?
No, actually, that's a much broader study of the question of power in the world, economic and political power. And it's about how after the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a moment of ascendancy for the United States through international institutions, through the so-called Washington Consensus of economic policy. There was an assumption that the whole world was going to become America. You know, what Thomas Friedman says, the world is flat. It turns out, of course, that the world is not flat, and great inequalities have emerged in the last two decades since the Soviet Union has fallen, and new contradictions have come. For instance, the so-called emerging countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the BRICS countries, have posed a serious challenge to the unilateralism of U.S. power. And alongside that, you've seen the emergence of Latin American states, which in a very different way have tried to position themselves with an alternative policy. So that book is about the declining ascendancy of America and the emergence of a multilateral planet. It's actually very appropriate to the problem in the Middle East. The United States is going to have to recognize it cannot solve every problem. You need to allow regional solutions to develop. And if you're going to prevent regional solutions by pitting regional actors against each other, this is to the detriment both of the United States and the world.
We've been talking with Vijay Prashad, a professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, about the current situation in Iraq. Prashad is the author of 15 books, including the recent The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
Tune in Wednesday, August 13th at 2 p.m. when KBOO's Rita Rega will be talking to impresario George Ween, the creator of the Newport Jazz Festival. Listen to what this eyewitness to jazz history has to say about his festival and the film Jazz on a Summer's Day, playing Thursday, August 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Again, that's George Ween, interviewed by KBOO's Rita Rega, Wednesday, August 13th, 2 p.m., here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature people's movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KBOO Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about